Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. On our show today, we're going to discuss the future of Obamacare, the future of the economy, and what to expect from the next administration. You'll learn what happened during the last presidential election and where we must go from here.
I'm an American!
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have former presidential candidate for the Constitution Party, Daryl Castle. Daryl comes to us from sunny Memphis, Tennessee, where he runs one of the most prominent law firms in the country. Welcome, Daryl.
Thank you, Cynthia. I'm so happy to be with you.
Well, first, I want to thank you for doing a valiant job of upholding the principles that made our nation great. We're still all trying to calm down from what happened in the November election, and I know it will help us if you can share with us the final numbers and what lessons you learned from your candidacy. So have you evaluated what happened numerically on Election Day?
Well, yes, as best I can, anyway, I sure have.
Go ahead. Give it to us.
The last figures I saw was 177,000 votes for me, and that's without any of the write-in states being counted. Of course, there were, I think, 22 write-in states, some of which we expect quite a few votes. So once those votes are counted, that number will go considerably higher, we hope, but that's what it is as of right now. That would put me fifth in the country behind Trump, Clinton, Gary Johnson, and Jill Stein. But that is it from my standpoint. We accomplished a lot in this campaign, I think, a lot that's not reflected in the numbers. It was a wonderful thing. It was a great experience and a lot of hard work and so forth, but it was an important thing, something that needed to be done.
That's a good way to put it. It was something that needed to be done. Do you have any regrets?
Oh, no. I mean, I have disappointments, but I don't regret doing it. I mean, you can look back at any stage of your life and say, well, if I were doing that, I'd do it differently next time. So there were some things that looking back at it, I would certainly handle differently. But no, I don't regret doing it, not at all.
What in the campaign surprised you the most? Every campaign does have a few surprises. Is there something that happened along the way where you said, oh my goodness, how'd that happen?
Yes, I would say the biggest surprise, positive surprise, happy surprise, I guess you could say, would be all of the Republican activists that joined us after Ted Cruz left the race, and the Libertarians who joined us after Austin Peterson was defeated in the Libertarian race. Without those people, my campaign wouldn't have been nearly as effective. They were tremendous. The ones who came, I mean, they stuck with us, and they carried social media. They pushed it through. They brought in a whole new lot of people who have never even looked at the Constitution Party and really didn't even know what it was. But they made the difference in the campaign. They were a joy to work with, and that was, I suppose, the biggest surprise.
I'll agree with you there, Daryl. I've run more campaigns than you have, and it always amazes me. Every campaign I've ever had, there have been a different collection of people who were my people. It's interesting the way that works, because you would think you'd always have the same people. But without doubt, I've always had a different treasurer. I've had a different campaign manager. I've had different people who want to walk door to door. There is no way to explain it except different seasons for different times. So I want to talk to you about policy and what you expect is going to happen. And I want you to make a few predictions. When we were at the meeting in Pittsburgh, you gave a magnificent talk about how Obama sent our troops over to the Middle East. They dropped off billions of dollars of military equipment and then just left it behind there for ISIS to use. I want you to tell us that story and tell us why we didn't bring it back home. And what do you think is going to happen to our foreign entanglements now that we have Trump moving into the White House?
Well, why we didn't bring it back home, I can tell you the actual reason, but I can tell you the stated reason, the economic reason, but the actual reason, I suppose, lies within the mind of politicians that run the country. But the stated reason is because it's cheaper to leave it than it is to bring it home. It's cheaper to make more than it is to load billions of dollars worth of this stuff and bring it home. So literally mounds and mounds of weapons are left behind, and all their ammunition and mechanized too. You know, ISIL had American armor and the American artillery, all kinds of things that they had, and certainly billions, tens of billions of dollars of American money that they got from the bank at Mosul that they looted. So yes, I mean that. That happens in Iraq. It happened in to some extent in Afghanistan when we reduced our forces there. But you ship the stuff over there, and what isn't destroyed or used up is usually abandoned. That's the way it is now.
I bet you the taxpayers would have been willing to pay to ship the stuff back, knowing that it was going to go to kill our people and kill a lot of other people and kill a lot of Christians over there.
Well, I was just going to say that the material that is brought back, they clean it, they bring it back, and quite often they have nothing to do with it. They could warehouse it somewhere out in the Arizona desert, I guess, like they do old World War II airplanes. But quite often they give it to the police departments. And so you have military hardware that is seen combat in the Middle East, going into the various police and law enforcement agencies around the country. And so, you know, you hear all these stories about this little town in some place having a tank, you know. Well, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Now, you had another question, and I interrupted you.
Well, I just want to comment. When is the last time you saw the national government worried about thrift and trying to be economical?
Yeah, that's for sure.
So I want to talk to you about Obamacare for a minute. The argument over whether it should be repealed or replaced. Back when it passed, the country had a Democrat majority in the House, the Senate, and the executive branch of the government. Then the Republicans were complaining, oh, we can't repeal it because there aren't enough of them. Well, there are enough of them now. We've got Republicans stocking up the whole Washington, D.C., the White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives. So I want to get your projection. Trump said he wants to keep the parts of Obamacare where kids can stay on their parents' policies until they're 26. These are adult grown children who are even married. After they're married, they still stay on their parents' policy. And he also wanted to keep the part where nobody can be turned down. So I'll just tell you what I would do if I were elected the president. I would just simply remove the mandate, and then it would disassemble itself under its own weight. What do you think is the right way to navigate through this, and what do you think is going to actually happen?
Well, I mean, your suggestion is certainly a good one. I don't claim to be an expert on healthcare, but I do think that Mr. Trump has set up a website called greatagain.gov that is supposed to spell out his policy priorities, and he lists in there repeal the Affordable Care Act as one of his party policies. But he is an interesting mix of people. He's a he's an American nationalist. That's obvious. And he mixes in with that that little bit of socialism that the American people seem to like, you know, that says when you can't help yourself, the government's going to step in and help you. That type of appeal. But what will be done? I mean, best guess is, like you say, it'll be some type of system that he and Ben Carson and some other people devise with a little bit of Obamacare left in it, but what's not going to happen is a free market healthcare system. At least that's the way it appears.
Well, that makes me sad, Daryl. We need a free market health system if we're going to get the costs under control. It's not about some ideology. It's about we're paying out the wazoo and we can't afford it. And if we're not going to go free market, there is no way to economize once you snip the desire of people to contain their own costs. You have to turn the patients back into consumers. And unless we go that way, we're not going to do free market. And our system needs free markets to work. I believe Obamacare really ended up enriching the insurance companies. I don't know where all the money went, but I know that the John Q. average has less money in our pockets and less money in our bank account because we're spending more on premiums. I know a lot of doctors are saying they have less money. So who's getting the money?
Well, that's hard to say. But I mean, during the campaign, I used to say that I agreed with Bill Clinton and his take on Obamacare. He said it's a crazy system where 25 million people who did not have insurance before suddenly have insurance, and all those other millions and millions of people out there, working stiffs who work, they're out there, and use his language, busting it, some of them 60 hours a week. Their premiums double, and their coverage drops in half. So he says that's a crazy system. Well, it is. A mixed up, convoluted system where if you don't want it, you have to pay a tax, John Robert called it. But obviously, I would have brought in people who could help me return this healthcare system to the free market and do it in that way where the consumers determine prices and things of that nature. But I doubt if that is what we'll see now because the government is in, has been since the early 70s to some degree in healthcare. And under Trump, it will probably remain there. So many of the things he said in his campaign rhetoric seemed to indicate to me that he wanted the same things that Hillary wanted in so many different areas, but he proposed to do them better. He would be more efficient. He would make it work better, but the same basic concepts.
I want you to tell me what is your greatest disappointment from this campaign. But I want to go first. I want to tell you one of the biggest disappointments that I saw. I know you got a big boost from some of the Ted Cruz supporters, and I think that's wonderful. There's no question that Ted Cruz would have been more constitutional than Donald Trump. But also, he had a problem because he wasn't a natural born citizen. And I don't know why everybody's all huffy about it. Whenever we say these words, it brings out a level of hostility that is inappropriate for civilized human beings. The fight never was over whether we think somebody is a U.S. citizen or not. The root of the contention was that very few people even know the definition of a natural born citizen with which to have that conversation. They keep thinking we're saying he's not a citizen, and they've never been educated on the topic. So they tend to resort to name calling. There are a lot of people who shut off their brains to learning anything. We saw this when Barack Obama ran. We could have settled it back then. We didn't. I don't get what we're going to have to do to help people figure it out. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that, as they often say in politics, we've gone beyond that question. We accepted the questions about President Obama, and we accepted the questions about Senator Cruz. And people who support those two people view any questioning of their definition of natural-born citizen not applying to these two men. They see that as you're some kind of lunatic, like a conspiracy theorist or something. I mean, I took the position during the campaign that Ted Cruz did qualify as a natural-born citizen, and I said that had I been a Republican, which thankfully I'm not, I would have voted for him in the primaries. I do think he was the best of the Republican candidates. But yeah, I mean, there's a attitude of when you question something and you want to see some type of investigation or something, it's like it's a personal attack or something like that. That's the way it's kind of gone.
A lot of hostility there. And just for the benefit of the listeners and your benefit, Daryl, the only reason I can speak to this is because I've taken the time to study it. And everybody thinks we're talking about where a person was born, which has nothing to do with it. According to the law of nations, you have to have two parents who are U.S. citizens, and then you're a natural born U.S. citizen. That's my understanding. Is there some part of that that I got wrong?
No, according to the law of nations, natural law, your answer is correct. That's my understanding anyway.
So I want to hear still if there's anything that disappointed you about the campaign.
Well, yes, not getting ballot access in my own home state, even though it was very easy to do, was not just the most disappointing thing of this campaign, but probably the most disappointing thing of my entire Constitution Party life, which has encompassed some 25 years now. But it was very disappointing, and even to get on as an independent is relatively easy to do. We failed to do it, and that was because of mix-up and mistakes within our own state party. But that was a big disappointment. Number two, I would say that the people of Utah, even though I spent a considerable amount of time out there, went out there twice, spent several days there, spoke all over the state both times, had my VP candidate from Utah, and I was assured by Utah press and other people that I would really do well there. I didn't. And they chose instead this neocon Republican who came in at the last minute by people who by their own admission, wanted to get Hillary Clinton elected. They chose Evan McMullen instead of me. That was a big disappointment.
I saw that.
Yeah,
I was very surprised, Daryl, that somebody could come from out of nowhere and gain that much publicity. And then the news was that Glenn Beck endorsed you. And then a couple weeks later, the news was he doesn't know if he wants to endorse you or even McMullen. What in the world happened there?
I did four separate interviews with the Glenn Beck Show. Two of them were done by his alter egos, Pat and Stu, and two of them were done by him. But Pat and Stu really liked me. I mean, they expected me to be some kind of country rube, you know, some hillbilly tin hat kind of thing. That's the way these people look at the Constitution Party. That's one of the things I discovered in this campaign. That's one of the eye-opening things I discovered is how people out there in the world really look at us. And when people would interview me from mainstream news, and I'll call Glenn Beck that, they're shocked that I am actually an educated, literate person. They expect you to find some toothless hillbilly, you know. So anyway, they liked me. They liked what I had to say. They and so they invited me back. And I heard one of them say that he was going to write me in Texas because I wasn't on the ballot there. So Glenn had me on, and he liked me too. So he, you know, we were quick to call it an endorsement, and I was. I took advantage of what he said. There's a video where he says he's going to vote for me. We've still got that video. He made a video specifically saying he was going to vote for me. And then later he said he was having second thoughts. He was looking at Evan McMullen. But then he had me back on late in the campaign and seemed to indicate again that he would vote for me. So I still call it an endorsement. And I had many, many people who, some of them didn't even know I was a candidate, who saw that original video that he did where he said he was going to vote for me and mentioned it to me in church and places like that. But that's all I know about it, Cynthia.
That's okay. I'm proud of you for getting on the Glenn Beck Show. You did a great job there. He does have a large following, and I'm proud of everything he did to help you in his little way. I don't think it helped him to appear conflicted, but that's not his issue. He's not about endorsing candidates. He's about him and his show. So one thing that surprised me was the Constitution Party supporters who jumped ship and got on the Trump train. I couldn't believe what I saw, because these are people who I thought were very principled and people who've been with the party since its inception, decades with the party. What do you think caused that? And I know what caused it. They were afraid, what if Hillary wins? This is not the time for us to go third party. We've got to get Trump elected at all costs. Did you see any of that?
Yeah, that's what caused it, in my view. I certainly did. You know, there were the people who just quietly went about their way and voted for Trump. I have no problem with that. If that's what they wanted to do, they didn't do anything one way or another. They just voted for Trump. That's okay. But there were many, many Constitution Party members who actually tried to hurt my campaign, who publicly did things to influence people not to support me, things like that. That I have to admit was a very big disappointment. Some of them, a couple of times we wrote them and said, you know, we've been friends for a long time. You vote for who you want to, but please don't try to damage our website and things like that. There was a lot of that, but a lot of them just simply did nothing. Nothing to help us, nothing to hurt us. But it's like the whole country. It was a very, very important and vital time in America, and they just felt like that that Trump simply had to be elected. They couldn't use even their self to support anyone else.
Well, what happens when that occurs is it sends a message to all the candidates that you can't count on your party to promote you. And when I saw some of this stuff happening, people even took pictures of their ballot supporting Trump, who everybody knows who they are and what they did. The negative fallout from this is it is a disincentive. And I said to myself, boy, I'm glad I wasn't running on the top of a ticket where people would betray me and go for somebody else at the end. What do you think we need to do to attract more candidates?
I think we need to take a hard look at our party. I learned a lot in this campaign. I learned a lot about myself, about my wife, who is my campaign manager. I learned a lot about Republicans who came in and helped me, and thank God they did. I learned a lot about the party, about the Constitution Party, and a lot of people who, as you say, have led it. Some of them are on the executive committee who spent their campaign trying to hurt me. Some of the candidates that opposed me for the nomination, who I defeated for the nomination, actually went out and campaigned against me. Things like that. What we need to do, we need to take a hard look at this party, Cynthia. It needs to be revised. We need to do some things to revise it, and I'm going to be addressing those things from my standpoint, through my eyes, as they say, at the National Committee meeting in December when I speak there. I'm going to do my best to address them anyway. Republicans, our party is founded on a different principle. The Republican Party and the Democrat Party would never permit that sort of thing. You know, people tried to do it to Trump, Priebus sent them a note saying, you're going to be shut out if you do this. So they have discipline, but we don't. Our party was founded on the concept of state sovereignty. Everybody was very attuned to that. Not all the states formed new parties. Some of the states simply brought in parties already existing into the Constitution Party, and state sovereignty was very important. So these parties were, the whole thing was set up so that everybody had total party sovereignty to do what they wanted, and the national party would not control them, discipline them, or anything like that. So you have a completely independent group of people. But just from a personal standpoint, as you pointed out, I've known many of these people for decades. We're friends. And not only did they do nothing to support me, but they actually went around trying to hurt me, which is so disappointing. If they had any idea how hard it is to do this, how expensive it is, how taxing it is on every aspect of your life, if they would just done nothing, it would have been greatly appreciated. But I'll talk at length as much as I can, as much as Frank gives me the time to do it, about what I think this party should do, not just to attract candidates, because if you have candidates without any support, what difference does it make?
But you're right.
Yeah.
That's an excellent point. If we have candidates without support, what difference does it make? And I understand, too, that's the point of having a party. If you don't have any support, you might as well run as an independent. That's one of the bonuses of running with an established party, is you are entitled to support from the party. So what does the Constitution Party need to do to boost its image? There are some people who are saying that the Constitution Party needs more exposure. Well, it's hard to get exposure if you're not on the nightly news. And yet there are people who are saying, well, maybe it's not time for a third party. When is it going to be time for a third party, if not now? When?
Well, to answer your question, I'm not going to completely answer it, because some of these things, as I said, I want to reserve for the National Committee meeting, where I'll just be talking to people on that committee who are there physically present. But it is time for a third party, but this particular third party has got to look into its soul and see where it wants to go. We talk a lot in our party about how everybody's against us. It's like a coach tries to convince his football team that they're all against me. Everybody thinks we're going to lose. He does that to try to motivate them, The little guy against the big guy, Well, everybody, the media is against us. The Democrats and Republicans control access to the ballot, so we can't achieve anything. Nobody will talk to us. That's all true. It's very, very difficult, but it's not impossible. This particular campaign was the greatest opportunity for this party in the history of the party. It was maybe one of the greatest opportunity ever in history. And we flubbed it. I didn't. It may sound egotistical. I hope it doesn't. But the fact is, I was a very good candidate. My campaign manager and I, and with the assistance of some dear people like Bob Peck and Karen Mary, we did more with less than any candidate this party's ever had. We got on the ballot in 24 states and as a write-in in 22 others, and we raised only $67,000 the entire campaign. And $24,000 of that was spent in a failed effort to get ballot access in Ohio. So we did a lot with very little, and a lot of it we did just on our own resources and our own sweat and labor and so forth. But this party needs to it's going to have to look at itself, and I'm going to hold the mirror in front of it in December and say, take a good look, folks. let's decide where we want to go. Do we want to just be a debating club that meets every 6 months and we talk to each other? You know, I made a concerted effort this time to go out among people who did not know this party. That's what all those Republicans were. They didn't even know who we were. And they think the party is me, but hopefully they won't have their opinion changed very much when they come to the meeting in December, which I've invited many of them to, and I think some of them will probably come. But we're going to have to go outside of ourselves and reach out. I learned why so many people will not accept us into the mainstream, not even like they do the libertarians or the Greens. They're less terrified of them than they are us. Because, as I said earlier, they think we're just a bunch of uneducated country rubes who don't know anything. And, you know, we're a bunch of conspiracy theorists. And that's the way they see us. And they see us as frightening because we have so much religious rhetoric. They're more afraid of a conservative Christian than they are a Muslim. They see them as threatening because so many times, I mean, I can't tell you countless times I had to answer the question, well, are you, if you were elected, would you try to enact a theocracy? And people were on and on about my religion, you know, and then they even go into not just the fact that I'm a Christian, but which Christian denomination I am. And people would call me up on my own home phone and berate me about my church. And I used to say, look, if you don't like the church I'm a member of, why don't you choose one of the atheists that run all the other parties? Those are questions that the public has to be made aware that those are areas that they should be reassured about. They're not threatening areas. And I tried desperately to do that with people. And I think I made a lot of inroads into letting people know that this party was something to be accepted and welcomed. I know among those Republicans, I had some success doing that.
You did. I was impressed. And I'd like to thank you for running a good campaign. I was at a Bible study last night, and we were all sitting around the table eating dinner, talking about politics. And one of my friends down at the end of the table said, well, my guy didn't win. And I had to ask, who was that? And he said, Daryl Castle. So I was very proud of you. I think you have you've got a lot to be proud of, buddy. You did a good campaign. Not bad for a lawyer.
Well, having people like you say that makes all the difference. You know, I tried to run the campaign like I do my life, you know, as the way a Christian gentleman should behave. Yeah, it was such an important time for America. And many people have done what you just did. Many, many people have emailed me and posted things on Facebook and other social media about how the campaign was inspiring to them, and they appreciated having somebody that they could vote for and things like that, you know, somebody without scandal in his life and that type of thing. So I'm very grateful for that.
Well, great. And you did develop and cultivate. You cultivated a new group of supporters. What is going to happen to them? You were quoted as saying we need to build a constitutional coalition. What is a constitutional coalition, and how do we keep people together who are like-minded?
That is the question that has to be answered, and it's probably too early to answer it. I mean, we asked those Republicans that were very supportive of me at the end if how many were going to stay with us and how many just came with us because they didn't like their own party's candidate. They were upset more with more than just Trump, though. They were upset with the way the Republicans behaved in the nomination process. They felt disenfranchised. And many of them have said they are going to stay, and they're going to try to build strong state parties. And if I'm able, I plan to help them do that as best I can. We could use their ideas. I mean, some of these people are really good. I mean, they really have a lot to contribute. Their youth, which is sorely needed in our party, as you probably know, many of these people are very young. They're very talented. They're very energetic. Those are all things that we could use. And so I'm trying as hard as I can to get them to stay in our party and work and help build it. Constitutional coalition, I suppose that means people from across different political parties, different areas of life who believe that the Constitution is important and that they want to see it preserved and protected and followed and so forth. We could bring them together under the Constitution Party banner. That would be a good thing.
One thing I like about what we're doing is we have a positive message. There's so many good things going on. The stock market went up to a record high after Trump was elected. If you were a betting man, do you think Trump is going to be able to really turn the economy around?
I think he's going to be able to accomplish a lot of things that he thinks he can, but I think that there are problems in our economy that only Jesus could solve. Unfortunately, I think when those problems start to take hold, he and the Republicans will be blamed for it. I hope and pray that I'm wrong about that, but I do think there are fundamental problems. They're not cyclical. They're not part of the business cycle. They're fundamental. And those fundamental changes are going to have to be made one way or another, and the country is going to go through an economic valley. The question becomes, will it be violent or will it be peaceful? I pray that it's peaceful, and I pray that I'm wrong about all of that.
I pray you're wrong about that, too. And even when we were discussing our loss of freedom in this country, it shocked me to see the debate when both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump seemed to be in favor of more regulatory burdens on gun owners. There are a few places where they had a little too much in common for my comfort level. And I don't know how, with fiat money and with the wanton spending, we've got reckless spending thanks to our Republican Congress that has mortgaged our future. I don't know how we're going to veer back out of the ditch. And so what you're saying is maybe the economic manipulators could design the catastrophe to happen on Trump's watch, and then thereafter his legacy will be that he crashed the plane and trashed the country.
Well, something like that, whether it's designed or whether it's simply fundamentals. I mean, sooner or later, this $20 trillion worth of debt and growing is going to have to be dealt with. And you know, there's shaky news all around the country, around the world. On December 4th, the Italians have a referendum similar to what Britain went through with Brexit, referendum as to whether or not they're going to leave the union. And, you know, the Italian banks, I mean, some of these banks are old. They go back, they financed the Roman Empire. They're very shaky now and on the edge of failing. They owe everybody in the world, and everybody in the world owes them. You know, it's the world financial system is very, very shaky. And whether it can survive another 4 years without collapse, well, time will tell. You know, I pray that it can, but I have my doubts.
So Thanksgiving is right around the corner. What is on your list of things you're thankful for this year?
Well, I'm thankful for my family, my wife. I've been married to for 38 years in the early part of December. That'll become 39. And I'm thankful that I lived through this campaign somewhat intact. My law office is still here. It needs some work, but it's still working. And I'm thankful that I'm an American, that I was born here, that I live in a country where we can still be free. That's something worth fighting for. You know, I just thank God that he found me and that he made me a Christian. I thank him for that every day of my life. And it is so good to be an American, to live here in America. That is something I'm very, very thankful and grateful for.
And even though you weren't able to be victorious in an electoral sense, I think you can feel you were victorious in a philosophical sense. And I mean, we all won by the fact that Hillary Clinton is not about to be sworn in next month.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I wish that that I were moving to the White House, but I do think that this election was very, very good news for America. People who are on the political side that we are should see this. I mean, Americans in general sensed that our culture is dying. Our standard of living is dying. This was possibly our last chance to reverse that in this country, regardless of the personalities. I mean, take Donald Trump as a personality out of it. It might have been our last opportunity to send a message to people that says, you know, look, folks, we're more concerned about 40 million people on food stamps than we are making sure that people who are very confused about what gender they are can go into little girls' locker rooms and things like that. People are sick and tired of all that, and they're sick and tired of people telling them they want hemispheric open borders when only 50% of us pay tax to support all these people. They see through that. They were tired of it. Maybe this was the last chance to send that message. So I'm grateful for that.
And there were a lot of people who said that God showed up. We prayed. Our nation had more prayer going on. There were people who were posting on Facebook that they were praying every hour and inviting others to join with them on Election Day. I worked inside the polls on Election Day, a 15-hour day. I got there, and by 20 minutes before the polls opened at 6 a.m., there was a line forming outside, which surprised me because I've never seen a line that early. By the time the polls opened up, the line wove around the parking lot and out to the street. It was to the point where no more cars could even get into the parking lot. We got through 2.5 hours of mayhem trying to process voters as fast as possible. And then as the day progressed, it calmed down. We got up to 3:15. I looked at my watch and I announced to my other poll workers, in a few minutes, by 4 o'clock, we're going to start the evening rush. It's going to be just as bad as the morning rush. It's going to last probably 3 more hours of craziness. Well, it shocked me. People I know across the country were praying that God's will would be done. And even though what happened in Missouri may not be indicative of the rest of the country, but the rush never happened. The big crush of people who were going to come out and vote late in the day didn't ever show up. The busloads never showed up. The biggest thing is that the people who Hillary was counting on to put her in the White House at the end of the day didn't show up. That's why she lost. Actually, I heard that Donald Trump won by fewer votes than Mitt Romney had when he lost. But there were enough bad actors or people who didn't care about the future of our country who sat this one out. And that saved us.
Well, let me just kind of bring down all this giddy happiness you and I are going through and tell you that a majority of people, because she won the popular vote, a majority of the people in this country voted for a person under investigation by the FBI for multiple felonies, a person who by the FBI's admission, committed gross negligence, at the very least gross negligence, in handling the country's top secret information while she was Secretary of State, a person who used her office, what in a turn of phrase, say, pay for play. In other words, you did not talk to the Secretary of State unless you donated money to her foundation. A person who talked on and on ad nauseum about women's rights, gay rights, and all this stuff, but took $30 million from a country who persecute gays, who execute them, who treat women. They're not second-class citizens. I mean, they're like chattel property. They can't drive a car. They can't go out in public without being totally covered from head to foot. These are the people that supported her campaign. And so people started to see through that lying hypocrisy. But at the same time, a majority of people who voted for her. that shows you, that says something about America and about America's future.
That's good. Thank you, Daryl. I have a lot of respect for you and for what you did. Give us one more gem of hope. Give us what you believe we need to do to pull ourselves together and go to the next level up.
Well, we need to pray and seek God's face. You know, quite often we quote 2 Chronicles 7:14, which says, "If my people who are called by my name," we quote that verse as what Christians should do, but we fail to read the rest of that chapter. If you continue reading, the Bible tells us what's going to happen if we don't do those things, and it's not a pretty picture. So we are going to have to come together and try to generate a little more enthusiasm, a little more commitment from a lot more people. We can't win elections with the pitiful response financially that I had. I mean, I appreciate every sacrifice that everybody out there made for me. I really do. But it is going to take a far, far greater commitment than that if this party in this country can be turned around and organized. But it can be done. That's the good news. That's what I came out of this campaign with. I saw the path to victory. It's difficult, but it's not impossible. The rules that the Democrats and Republicans have set up for us to follow, they're difficult, but they're not impossible. They can be done if we have the commitment, if we have enough people who are committed. We're starting the processes of trying to put those people together to do it.
Sounds good. Thank you. It's difficult, but it's not impossible. I love that. And if people want to learn more, they can go to DarylCastle.com. That's Daryl with two R's and two L's, Castle, Castle.com. You have done a tremendous service to this country. Thank you for everything you've done to encourage us and motivate us, spoken like a true Marine. Thank you, Daryl. Is there anything else you want us to know? You going to come back and give us an update again sometime?
Anytime, Cynthia. It's always a pleasure. I just respect you so much and what you've done over the years. Anytime you want me to be on, I'm there. You can count on it.
Great. Well, thanks so much. You have a good afternoon, and we'll talk to you again sometime.
All right. You too. Bye, Cynthia.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.